From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we're dedicating our entire program today to the subject of COVID-19. 4 years ago, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's first stay-at-home orders went into effect. At his side during that phase of the pandemic was a woman, a pediatrician by training, thrust into an unexpectedly public role as Illinois' Director of Public Health. Today, Dr. Ngozi Ezike is the president and CEO of the Sinai Chicago Health System. She joined me earlier this week to reflect on those early days of the pandemic. Dr. Ezike, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us again.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I want to go back before COVID-19 and talk about your early time in office, right? You joined a peacetime health department. What were your initial priorities in coming into the Department of Public Health?
Oh, yeah. So I was advised just pick, you know, two or three things that you can focus on, get done, and know that you've left the health department and the state better than when you started. And I know we were just on the heels of putting out this landmark study on the report on maternal mortality and the significant racial and ethnic divide in terms of the results. And so we were just going to really wrap ourselves around that and make sure that that was a priority and make some headway there. And the second thing was that we were going to build a new public health laboratory, that the laboratories that we had, we needed at least one upgrade, and we were going to redo the one in the Chicagoland area. So those were, you know, like in addition to the 200 programs that IDPH carries on all the time, like those were the two big things that would be the foci of my tenure. Yep, I remember that.
So one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation is I think a lot of us have sort of forgotten or memory hold the sort of depths of the pandemic and what those early days were like. Can you talk about your first moment when you realized that this story coming out of China was going to be a major public health crisis? It was going to be something you would have to deal with and maybe would upend your entire tenure with the state.
And the reason people are trying to forget is because it's a protective mechanism, right? So I understand why people are trying to distance and forget. I think it was clear, it was early for us because we did have an early case. You know, our first diagnosed case came in January. And even before that, when the first case actually hit in Seattle, you know, as the public health director for the state, we were already on regular calls with the CDC, with all the other health officials from around the country. And they were starting to plan about special screening protocols that would be enforced at some key international airports. And, you know, O'Hare was going to be one of them. So there was a lot of, it's not the right word, but buzz that something was definitely happening. So it was in January. It was shortly after the holidays.
There was talk, though, that, oh, it's just a bad flu, not that big a deal. Did you feel like you grasped early on how significant it could be, how much death there might be?
Goodness, no. I'm glad that my mind couldn't go there. But, I think with some of the early reports, I'm a pediatrician, they were mentioning, you know, the type of virus it was. And you're like, well, that's a kind of a normal childhood type virus, that shouldn't be, you know, that shouldn't be so bad. Or maybe it's, you know, maybe a little bit worse than what we are used to in kids. I mean, of course, no one imagined the depth or the breadth. But when we started hearing the stories in China and see some of the images, it wasn't something manufactured. So clearly, those images started to tell or forecast what we might be dealing with. And that was pretty jarring.
How did it feel for you to be suddenly thrust into such a public high stakes role? You had mentioned your priorities for the health department. Neither of those things, you know, working on maternal health or building a new lab, they don't require daily news conferences next to the governor. What was that like for you?
Yeah, no, that it was obviously unexpected, not something I was prepared for. I didn't have any media training. I think we maybe did some press around the vaping incidents, the deaths that happened related to vaping. That happened before this. And I think we did a press conference or two around that, but definitely nothing could have prepared me for this. Wasn't anticipating all of that in front of the camera type of action. Like, by definition, public health is doing great when you don't even think about them and when you're not understanding what they're doing, because things are, you know, the trains are running on time and things are smooth. And that's where public health hangs out, behind the scenes. So this was a complete role reversal, but, you know, it wasn't something that you had a choice of, like, do I want to do this or do I want to continue to stay in the background?
No, I like how you frame that, because it's like with food inspections of restaurants. If you're thinking about it, it means something bad has probably happened.
Right.
All right. So in those early days, you have to make all these decisions. You're advising the governor. You're getting advice from people you work with, I imagine. There's communication among different public health officials, state, federal, local. How were you thinking through decisions in that time, right? We have an evolving scientific understanding, still pretty limited. But there's this push to begin taking immediate action, especially as we're coming into March 4 years ago.
Yeah. No, this was a time where, you know, there was so much uncertainty and there were nonstop calls, you know, with the CDC, with my fellow brothers and sisters at the head of the health department through our trade association, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers. So constantly discussing. I was listening to every podcast that I could find from, you know, credible public health and infectious disease leaders, listening to everything on 2.0 speed just to get as much in as I could. The main thing was listen to what is known and try to make decisions on that. And then there was a lot of, well, since we are all in this together, like, there's some comfort and some cover in trying to do it the way other states are doing it. There's some comfort and there's some cover in doing what the CDC recommends, so that if someone says, well, how'd you come up with that plan? Oh, well, that's what was recommended. So those were some of the things that were thought about. Obviously, as we moved through the pandemic, there were different decision points where maybe, you know, you go differently based on new things that you're thinking about or things that you're seeing, you know, in your communities. So it was just a constant evolution. Like, it was an evolution that was not slow. Like, it was an evolution that was happening at record pace.
And you're right. In the early days, the states, the federal government were largely moving in lockstep, it seemed, at least to this observer. But it wasn't too long before different states started going in very different directions in terms of isolation recommendations, school opening and closing, for example. How did you navigate that, as, you know, certainly as we saw Florida and other states really pursued a more open policy than Illinois did?
Yeah, I think one of my guiding principles was that if you maintain life or save life, some of the sequelae or bad effects that can come with it, you might still have a chance to fix it. So if a business is hurt or something, you lose ground on something, but you're alive, you have a chance to try to ameliorate some of those other issues. But if you're gone, you don't, right? That was kind of what I was thinking. And so think the preservation of life was something that I held as kind of the North Star. And I really had a problem with some of the other ideas, like, well, the vulnerable people will just go. That's how it goes, like survival of the fittest, and not having as much respect for trying to save more lives. So, I mean, there are different ways that people can look, obviously, at the same situation. And based on what principles you hold up, that's going to influence the decisions. And I think that's what influenced ours.
And of course, we can go in hindsight and Monday morning quarterback, whatever expression you want to use. There was a real social emotional toll, though, right? Especially among young people, high school students, isolated from their peers for extended periods of time. Do you have any, and not to sort of, again, relitigate the past, but for next time, how might we approach things differently, keeping in mind that there was a significant toll to the isolation?
No, for sure. We know that people aren't meant to be isolated. And of course, like, you know, when they say hindsight is 2020, like, it's almost comical. Like, that was especially true for the year 2020, right? It's the fact is that we don't know what it looks like if you take option B. Like, it's easy to say, oh, all that isolation, it was so bad. And of course, there are ramifications or repercussions that we're seeing now. But taking a different path, I don't know where that would have ended up. I don't know what that would have done to the infection rate and the trajectory of lives lost. Would that have made it even greater? So instead of having the social isolation, you would just have many more people, like many more orphaned kids, right? And many more grandparentless kids. And what's the effect of that? So it's easy to criticize the decision made or just think about what if. It's just, you can never actually know what that what if would have looked like as well. And I don't know for sure that it would have been better. So those are just questions that won't ever get answered.
As you've thought about the backlash to some of the public health guidance we've seen in recent years, from stay-at-home orders or requests to masking recommendations to even vaccines, and now we've seen backsliding in other diseases like measles, for example, I wonder if you think we are better or worse off heading into whenever the next pandemic comes, be it in a year or 10 years or 100 years.
Yeah, I find it very hard to answer that just because of some of the things you've laid out. Obviously, we learned that politics and pandemics don't mix well. And I think that would probably come up as an issue again, most unfortunately, most regrettably. I think, you know, before there was COVID, we were dealing with measles cases in Illinois and many outbreaks due to the decisions against vaccination. So that was a problem before the pandemic. And there's still all this debate about vaccines, despite them really being like one of the greatest innovations in medical technology of the 20th century. So that just means there's a lot of work to do in terms of education. But I really can't see what would happen exactly, because I think the division that we have in our country will lead different groups to act very disparately. And that lack of unity could be problematic, could be significantly problematic for any kind of efforts to mobilize and unify us to do what's necessary for the greater good. This idea of working for the greater good as opposed to self, like the rugged individualism, that doesn't work well in public health, the rugged individualism concept. And so being able to navigate that the next time around, it will be a challenge for sure.
We're 4 years now since the start of the pandemic stay-at-home orders, when this really became a public issue. I wonder for you, what has stuck with you from your time leading Illinois' public health response to the pandemic?
I think I can answer that on, I guess, several levels. You know, personally, I learned that I can, you know, withstand some pretty tough circumstances. I learned kind of what can power me to get through some of those tough circumstances. I think I built an even stronger faith. I think societally, I did see, you know, we saw the good, the highs and the lows of humanity, but trying to focus very much on the highs and the good things, I saw healthcare systems that typically see themselves as competitors of each other really put that aside and work together to figure out how they were going to take care of people throughout the state. I saw collaboration between doctors in Northern Illinois and Southern Illinois sharing best practices to make sure that some of the innovations that they had helped to bring about in short order, that they could share that with other people. We saw government work nimbly and quickly, something that people think is impossible. So I can see all of those good things and focus on that and hold on to those as significant landmarks of that era.
Well, now you are working as CEO of the Sinai Chicago Health System. How did the pandemic experience change your approach to medicine and health leadership?
I mean, it has made me really fully grasp and understand the power of teamwork and the power of collaboration and really having the right team members around you in order to have the best chance at success. It's made me almost a little bit dangerous because to say that something is impossible, like, just doesn't resonate anymore. So it gives me this kind of superpower that says, okay, it hasn't been done yet, as opposed to just it can never be done. So I love that strength and optimism that I bring to each challenge. And I'm facing quite a few as the leader of the largest private safety net health system in Illinois. But it's also so invigorating to know that there is an answer out there. I just have to go find it.
Dr. Ngozi Ezike, thank you for being with us again on the 21st Show.
What an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, a very long 4 years of long COVID. It's the 21st Show. Stay with us.